Hello, and welcome to Teacher Tales, a podcast from the spirit of teaching. This is your host, Linda Markley, and I invite you to join me and my guests as we get curious, explore, discover, and learn more about what is really at the heart of teaching. In each episode, we will hear the story of a teacher, what called them to teach, what are their greatest joys and challenges in teaching, what inspires them, and what are their hopes, dreams, and vision for the education of children. We will learn more about the greatest lessons they have taught and also the greatest lessons they have learned. No checklists, no standards, no reports, no paperwork, and no data. Just stories from their hearts to our hearts on a journey to celebrate what really matters in the true spirit of teaching. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Teacher Tales. Today, my guest is Bonnie, and she is from North Carolina, but she's also originally from very far away, and I'm going to let her tell you about that and introduce herself. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, everyone. This is Bonnie Wong. I come from Northeast China. 11 years ago, I arrived in Portland, Oregon for my bachelor's degree. And about 9 years ago, I came to North Carolina first for my master's program at UNC Linguistics Department. And then I started working at UNC as a Chinese lecturer. And now I am working at a private institution named Durham Academy. We are a pre-K to 12 school located in Durham, North Carolina. I teach upper school Chinese program.
Wow, that's quite a journey. So you went to school in China, right? And so you want to walk us through what it was like going to school in China, and then a little bit of the culture shock coming here and becoming a Chinese teacher, some of the really positive things and maybe some of the struggles that other people mm-hmm. should try to understand about mm-hmm. that journey.
Yeah. So same as everyone else, when you first entering a culture that is different from your own, before that, you have all those kind of assumptions. And some of those assumptions are from others' experiences or perspectives. Some of those assumptions are from your own observations from the TV drama or a film or other pop culture, right? So before I came to the United States, I was an English major student in my own university in China. I picked my major in English because I was good in my English exams before I entered my college. My university is called Northeast Normal University. It's a teacher college specializing in training teachers for public education system in China. I think at that time I was thinking about becoming a teacher. I was interested in becoming an English teacher in China, teach students with similar backgrounds of mine. And then there is an opportunity for me to study abroad. At that time I was having a minor class selection in psychology. So I was really interested in continuing my study in psychology. And I thought, how cool is it to study psychology in a second language in a different country? So I picked psychology as my major. And that's why I came to Portland, Oregon for 2 years. And at that time, I thought Portland, Oregon represents the United States, which to many people, I think if they are listening to this podcast, they must be laughing, or they were like, oh, like poor Bonnie. If you know about Portland, that's a weird city with weird things going on all time of a year, especially in the summer, because they have 2 months only that people can see sunshines at the most of their days, which is like June or July. So they plan all those interesting festivals, jazz music festival, other types of music festival, Rose Parade. And I think there was also some hippies or hipsters festivals happening in the summer. And when my dad visited me for my graduation, for my undergrad graduation, he was totally culturally shocked. I was an international student at that time, so I was introduced to many opportunities to meet new people, to get my interns, and just talk to people about my home culture. And I think when people are approaching me, they already knew a lot about Asia, and then they want to know more. So it's established on their existing knowledge. So that was probably my cultural shock back then. Another culture shock when I came down to the South, I think the Southern accent was the biggest challenge for me. I tried to understand what people are trying to say to me at fast food line, Walmart, Target, and even between me and my professor who has a Southern dialect. I was not very good at picking up the correct word based on what they are producing and based on what I heard. And I think when I was a student in China, I went to a public school in China. I have 50 to 60 classmates in each of my class from my first grade all the way to 12th grade. I went to the best public school in my region, in my city or province. There are many elite students who are super talented, super hardworking. And I was trying to compare myself to them at the beginning, but then I was realizing that I wasn't so gifted compared to many of them. So for several years when I was in my high school, I was depressed and anxious about my academic performance because I wasn't able to reach to the top 1% students of my whole region. When I came to the United States, I gradually healed this trauma brought back then to me by the academic stress. And I think even now when I think about the traumatized experience of being a student, thought that you are never good enough. And when I advise my current students, I keep stressing the importance of mental wellness to them and letting them know that I also had to overcome the trauma, and the trauma can last really, really long, and it can also represent it in so many ways. After you grow up, after you graduated, after you found your job, the trauma keeps coming along with you. It never goes away. And I, when I was in China, I lived with my grandparents for most of my time because my parents, they were too busy. They were too busy commuting between mm-hmm. the home and their workplace, which is a suburb of the city. So they rented an apartment next to my junior high school and senior high school so I can live closer to my school, avoiding the traffic. And I could also live with my grandpa at that time. And my grandpa will cook for me, making sure my life goes well. My parents will visit me once a week or twice a month when it's needed. So I had a really strong, I was really close with my grandpa. When I came to the United States, the second year I studied at Portland, Oregon, my grandpa passed away. When he passed away, it was in spring, but I couldn't go back to China because I didn't have the visa that I needed at that time to return back to the United States. And it's always something that I blame myself, but I also know that there's nothing that I could do at that time. So it was one of the hardships that I had to overcome when I was a undergrad in Portland. But then it made me stronger. So it made me more independent, that I want to show him that he can be proud of me. Being a teacher was a dream for not only me, but also from my family since I was little, because my family is not a scholar family. They grew up, especially my parents, they grew up observing knowledge is power. Knowledge can change people's lives. And neither of them had a college degree. So they emphasized a lot in my education, and they invested a lot of money and time for me to get tutored, to go to good schools. And they tried to make sure there's no distraction when I was in my academic life. So when I came to America, I also carried that dream along. And eventually being a teacher, it's a, I think my family members, they're even happier than me. They're so proud. But it's also something that I think it's my fate. It's something that I was born to be.
A lot of what we talk about in the spirit of teaching in the podcast is bringing that human element forward, that spirit of teaching forward. And we need more of that. Like we were talking about the mental health. And you said that I told you that I had gone to China. One of the most impressive things that I saw in the schools was in the morning, everyone was in the courtyard doing Tai Chi. And that is how they started their day. So you told me that you started doing some mindfulness and Tai Chi with your students, especially in a pandemic, because a pandemic this year was a lot of trauma for everyone, teachers and students. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Before COVID, I was trying my best to bring in a lot of cultural components, cultural elements from Chinese culture into my Chinese language and culture class. I've been doing calligraphy since I was little. So I brought in calligraphy as a part of our Chinese class. Every day seven, students know that the last day of the rotation, every class will have calligraphy for novice learners. For the Chinese, the first year Chinese, they will start from basic strokes, from the very simple seal scripts. And then for students who have taken the first year, starting their second year, third year, fourth year, some of my students, they started Chinese in the middle school. So when they come to the upper school, it's going to be their third year or fourth year. So then when they are, after they've introduced by me about the Chinese calligraphy basics, they will actually do projects in their class. Everybody look forward to the calligraphy day. Everyone's reflections every year I received is like my favorite, the highlights of my year is the calligraphy day. Not only because calligraphy day, they don't have homework. I think it's because of the just the nature of calligraphy. It's in the Chinese way. It's so slow. It's so mindful for many of them. Also, the way that I try to implement the calligraphy into my Chinese teaching is I try to pick the very basic Tang Dynasty poems and really teach my students the language behind those poems and the history behind those poets' personal experiences into the calligraphy instruction. So students, not only they practice calligraphy using brush and ink, they also know the actual history, the historic stories of the poets, the historic stories of this ancient time period. They also learned Chinese language on the calligraphy day. So since the pandemic started, we couldn't have calligraphy because everybody's at home. Our school shut down the in-person instruction in the middle of our spring break last year. So when we started the emergent remote teaching, it was the week of March the 14th, I think, or after that. I couldn't remember the details, but students were so shocked. Why in this place? Why now? And how bad could it be? Because my students, they were all born after 2003, after the SARS. And I was at their age. I was in my junior high school during the SARS. I remember those days when I went to school in the morning. My teachers take temperature for each student 3 times a day, and then they need to report it. I remember those days, every class, after every class period, we need to all stay in line and then go to the bathroom to wash our hands. So those memory came back a little bit, and I was like, it could be really bad. It could be affecting your academic performance. It could be affecting your whole life. Your daily routine will be changed forever. So we were talking about that in January, and then in February, we see some rising waves of anti-China, anti-Asian hate in February. We had several incidents reported in our own school that some people are saying inappropriate jokes about China associated with virus. So we've seen that January, February, and then we had several discussion the first week of March about, oh, there could be a shutdown, there could be a lockdown, but it's still really far from my students' own reality. They still think pandemic is far from us. It's still it's still happening, but it's happening in Asia, it's happening part of Europe, and it's still very far from the United States. So when the school told them, when March the 13th, the lockdown policy was announced by the federal government, I couldn't imagine how shocked my students are. I could think of their reaction. Some of them must be like screaming, some of them must be like want to get away. So at that time, my question was, what should I do beyond a teacher? As a teacher, I'm teaching them Chinese language and culture. As their advisor, as their friend, or just as a general educator, that's not something that we should focus on right now. I don't really care how much Chinese language they can pick up during a pandemic. I don't really care how much Chinese culture they can name during a pandemic. I really care if they can continue the next day. I care that if they can wake up the next morning and they can tell themselves like, today I have 3 classes, I'm looking forward to it. I care that in the end of their day, they close their eyes and they're like, oh, today I had several classes, I met those people online, I did this, I did that, I'm all good for today, and I can take care of myself tomorrow. I care that during the weekend, my students can really spend some restful time with their parents, their siblings, their family members, and then be the mature child in their family and then take care of their parents as well. So that's what I care. That's really, like, honestly, I was like, this is not a good time for moving forward on our curriculum. This is a good time for us to take a step back, to pause, and then to sit down and to ask each other, how are you? Even though I told my students, there's really no how are you in Chinese. There are some people are telling you, oh, this is how you translate how are you in Chinese. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. You say that phrase to a Chinese native speaker, they're like, what? Why do you ask me how am I? I wasn't feeling bad. I wasn't feeling worse. In Chinese, the way we say how are you is very specific. We ask you, Have you had breakfast yet? What did you had for your lunch? Are you going to your class now? How are you recently regarding your recent surgery or your recent illness? That's when we ask, how are you? When you know someone is not doing well. And when you're actually approaching people to greet each other, you use very specific phrases to ask their daily life. Are you still having 3 meals a day? What did you have for your dinner? What are you going to eat tonight? Even though I told my students, when I ask you, have you eaten yet? It doesn't mean that I'm gonna buy you food if you didn't eat. It's just a way to say, how are you? Mm-hmm. So I think when I realized that calligraphy is not a thing that we could do during pandemic because of just so many hassles, and I didn't really trust my students to use the brush and ink at home when I knew that they didn't prepare themselves to take online classes, their room must be like some of their rooms I already know because they show me the pictures. It must be messy and there's no place to put the calligraphy materials. I was like, what else can I do to help my students maintain their motivation and interest in at least my class? I couldn't ask their math teacher to not give them any homework. I couldn't ask their English teacher to give them like a mindfulness activity, but I could do something in my class to make them feel interested, still like they're still hopeful for life in general. One day, I think it was the first week, I showed my students several daily routines that Chinese students will do during the pandemic. One of them is the eye exercises, and one of them is the morning exercises. My students thought that's funny. And in the morning exercise video, I think one of the video shows a really short clip of Tai Chi. And previously I taught several of my graduates who actually learned Tai Chi really well, much, much better than me. I didn't know how to use the sword. I didn't know how to use the Tai Chi fan, but several of my students, they mastered it by themselves. They learned it from YouTube channels and they performed their Tai Chi performances on the stage in the auditorium for our Lunar New Year assembly. And I was like, is there something that you want to do for this? We don't need to do the sword thing. And I can't afford buying every one of you a fan, but we could do the one without anything in your hand, free hand move. And we could maybe do something that your teacher learned when she was a student years ago. So then they said, yeah, like it looks fun. We should do it. So I first learned it. It took me over a weekend to learn it, to relearn it. I still had some muscle memory from my elementary school PE class rotations. So I relearned everything. And the next week I start to teach them step by step, part by part. And I thought they could learn it in a very negative way, because who wants to put your computer aside and then move in front of your camera in during COVID? And also your teacher is not even, you're not even sure your teacher is looking at your moves, and you're not sure that your classmates are doing the right thing along with you. You're just all by yourself in front of your laptop in your empty room. I thought some of them would complain. I thought some of them will just stop doing it. But after a week, it was like magical. Students coming into the class and telling me that this is one class they are really looking forward to. One of them said, this is the only class they look forward to because of Tai Chi. And I was like, are you sure? Like, we only do like 5 minutes per class per day. And is that something that you really want to do? They said, yeah, like for some classes, we just sit there and we listen to the lectures. For some classes, we do a lot of asynchronous work by ourselves. But this one, at least we can see some of our classmates in the camera on the video, and we can move ourselves. And I know some of them couldn't continue their athletic training, or just in general, their workout. Everything is all paused at that time in March last year, in March 2020. So I was like, good, let's keep doing it. If you want to learn more, we can go all for it. So then a month later, I actually bought those professional Tai Chi performance clothes on the AliExpress, the Alibaba international trading company online. And I went to Cure Beach. I think it's south compared to Carolina Beach. They have beautiful sceneries there. And I asked my husband to record a professional Tai Chi performance video. In the video of 5 minutes, I later on, I edited it, I put music, and I narrated in Chinese with my own voice. And then I published it on YouTube. I showed it to my students. They were like, that's you? That looks so professional. And I said, you liked it? We are going all out here. So that's something that we all liked during the pandemic. Even my students, they still want to do it when we came back in person, hybrid, in a hybrid mode, started in August 2020, our fall semester started hybrid, and students were like, one thing that I'm looking forward to for the in-person days are we're going to do Tai Chi outside with our Wang Lao Shi, and we'll see each other this time with full body. And the first, I think the first time when the students, they were doing Tai Chi with me, they realized how different it is for them to do it in person along with other classmates outdoor compared to they are doing it by themselves in their own bedroom because they're being watched. And I also, I would correct their postures and they were like, this is so much better, but also this is very different than what I thought. Like it was already different and fun when I was doing it by myself in my bedroom, but it's even better when I get to do it along with other people. And the philosophy behind those postures, those moves, I told my students is, you see some of those names of the Tai Chi, like wide crane showing off the wings or high pad horses. A lot of them, they are named after the animals in nature. And that's what some of those moves are. That's the reason they were built, because people were imitating animals in the nature and trying to stay healthy at the same time. But what are they referring to? Of course, the animals that they look at every day, and they see how they are using their bodies and how we should mimicking their moves to make sure we train this part of our body and this part of our body. So I think there are some interesting discussion during the Tai Chi instructions is we are having this controversial insights of, I told my students everything needs to be really slow. That's what I've been taught when I was little. And I didn't understand that, but now it all makes sense. And then I said, when you are slow, you're squatting all the time for the 5 minutes, you will feel the burn of your muscle, but you also feel the energy flow from your fingers to your arm and then to your inner core. My students were like, I don't feel that. I'm just sore. I just feel painful. And I said, if you feel painful, that's too much. You should also feel relaxed. And they're like, how can you be relaxed and also slow? And you're also training your core at the same time. But then I was like, connecting that with your calligraphy practice, because in the calligraphy instruction, we also trained the students to be slow and with steady hands and moving all the strokes in a mindful way. And when they are making that association, they were like, aha. Wow, like everything, it makes sense. It's all under the same philosophy umbrella of this thing, like balancing, even being slow, that doesn't mean you're behind. There's no rush of everything. You need to focusing on the current. You need to take care of every part when you're moving your body during the Tai Chi. It's the same way as when you are taking care of every move of your brush when you are riding the strokes. So I think some of them still didn't get it, which is fine. It's going to take years. It took years for me to get everything. And that's what we were using as a starting, as a starter of the social emotional learning during the pandemic. My students really enjoyed the time of just putting themselves there and then really think of nothing but think of the current move and appreciating the time that we can still be with each other.
I think another connection I was making as you were describing it and what I experienced it, because when I came back from China, I started doing Tai Chi and it was like the best exercise ever for many reasons, for strength, for calm, for mental, you know, focus. But the energy of it, when you get a group together that are moving synchronously and flowing together, it is magic. It's magic. And it's a little bit of a manifestation of what it's like to be one person in a community. And when everybody is flowing together and doing things, you know, like synchronously like that. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's art. Yeah. And everything just kind of unfolds as it should. So what a great way to start a class or to get the kids in the mood for their other classes. The other teachers should be buying you Starbucks gift cards all the time. Like, thank you for sending Johnny to me in such a calm mood today.
Yeah, because for years I've seen our Spanish teacher, Liliana Simone, is teaching her students dance in the middle of her Spanish class. And I was thinking that, well, I can't dance and I can't even teach my student dance. And it's not something that it's a part of the Chinese culture that to dance freely. That's not something that it was in my thought, but now we have something comparable. We could do Tai Chi in the middle of it and we can still connect that with the culture that we're learning every day.
So I want to ask you about, it said that you co-founded Courageous Dialogues with Chinese Educators, a not-for-profit organization that supports educators to get more involved in diversity, equity, identity, and justice. So could you talk about that a little bit and also about how you've brought that to your teaching for your students and your diversity, and maybe tie it into the pictures that I asked you about, because we don't have a visual here on the podcast, but I can see you have some beautiful student projects behind you, and maybe kind of weave all that together.
Yeah, absolutely. The co-founding organization, Courageous Chinese, with Courageous Dialogues with Chinese Educators, I shouldn't take the full credits because I was co-founding it with my colleague and friend Vicky Wang from St. Paul Schools in Baltimore, Maryland. At the beginning, I co-founded this with Vicky, and it's really from a personal, I think the founding of our organization was from a very personal conversation between me and her. So I met her, I think, at ACTFL, and then I added her on Facebook, and I think she posted several personal stories on Facebook about herself and her daughter growing up as an Asian American teenager, and her grew up in America being an Asian American educator. And I was reading her stories, her posts on Facebook during pandemic, and it's really powerful. It charges me because I was like, oh yeah, like there's another Chinese teacher who look like me, who thinks like me. And we need more of that energy during the time when we are the one being the victim of blaming from international sources. So I was talking to her on Facebook and I was like, you know what? Like we should, our conversation helps each other, supports each other. And I think there are more teachers needs this right now. We should start with a small group of people and then we can bring this idea to more Chinese teachers who are at this time confused, mad, sad, and just hurt in general. So she and I, we keep talking, and it was really the founding of it happened after BLM last year, because we just found that as Asian American or Asian educators in many schools, we were being left out during the social injustice time. I think BLM is a really, really powerful social time that helps a lot of marginalized people like me found the inner power, found the ground to start work on something. And we started, she and I, and we found two other friends at that time. I think it was Sarah and Matt. We started a small group chat on WeChat and then we just talked to each other. At the first, it was really venting. It's a venting group chat. And then later, some of us had really good ideas of how do we bring this up as a special topic. And the topics at that time are really divided into two categories. One is how to stand in solidarity with our Black colleagues. And another purpose at that time is how to support ourselves of just becoming a stronger person as an educator who teaches less commonly taught languages, or a teacher who's like me, has a immigrant or international background, who are at that time, I was divided. I was sadly, I didn't know who I am. Who am I? When I was talking to my friends and families in China, we were focusing on specific issues. And when I was talking to my friends and colleagues in America, we are focusing on different issues. And I feel like that I need to put on different masks when I talk to different groups. And in the tricky time when the US and China relationship gets so severely bad, I couldn't pick a side. I was joking with some of my friends at the, last year. I said, I feel like I'm in a family that both of my parents, they are divorcing. They're about to divorce. And on both sides, they force me to pick a side. Like I have to pick a side to live with them. And I can't compromise. I can't say that I love you both. So I talked to Vicky. I said, I think many of us, we feel that we don't know what to do. We are also hurt at the same time. So can we have some speakers, putting the speakers together and then give some webinars? But then we realized that in the summer of 2020, there are too many online webinars. So we created social media and now we have a website. At that time we had social media on Facebook, Facebook group and Twitter. We were posting and reposting a lot of posts on the internet already. We followed several education organization who at that time were focusing on DEI projects. And really we want to build the bridge between Twitter and WeChat, but we need to work with other colleagues, mm-hmm. not only the Spanish teacher, Latin teacher, French teachers, but also teachers from other subjects to make our voices be heard, because we also have voices and we need to let people know that Chinese teachers, especially the one who have my background, many people will think that Bonnie Wong is from China, from a culture of being humble and being less progressive and being like whatever they are thinking, whatever they are putting the assumptions on me. And they may think that their opinions do not matter because they really don't put their opinions out there. They are trying to be neutral. And I've heard people saying that to me. I've heard people asking me, is that a cultural thing that your people usually don't speak out? Usually don't let other people know your opinions or requests. And I was like, I don't think so, because I'm a loud person. And I'm a person who never put up with anything if I'm in China. But because I'm an immigrant, I need to take care of my immigrant documents. I need to make sure I don't mess up with anything in my life in order to prove myself to be a potential good citizen to survive in this country. And that's not only from a Chinese immigrant's perspective. I think I've seen many immigrants in the United States, they live cautiously every day, no matter where their own no matter where their home country is. They live cautiously, they work cautiously, they work like a dog. They put their best at outside to everyone every day. They are the kindest people, and they try to make sure they have everything out there than people perceive themselves as. This person could be a good citizen for us. We need this person here. The most word that I need for people to talk about me is we need her. And that is not from my culture. That is from my immigrant status. I do not come from a culture, and I don't think there's any culture that people are coming from that the culture tells themselves to be to be extremely tolerant. But I think the system taught me that I have to be like this in order to survive, in order to continue studying here as a student or working here as a foreign worker or living here as a permanent resident or a citizen. Mm-hmm. So I think thinking about that, really, I see a lot of teachers who shared a similar background with me will need this specific group to support them, because I don't think there was any. When I was, before we founded this organization, I was a pretty active presenter and conference member in many association conferences, but I didn't see that there is a specific association that takes care of the mental wellness of Chinese teacher who are right now living in this very difficult time. And that's why we founded. And since last year, we founded in June, we hosted monthly affinity group meetings with very small groups, because that's what we want. We want the conversations to be as deep, as personal as possible. So we never recorded our meeting. And we also want those groups to be sustainable. We follow up with them. We send those people who attended our affinity meetings a secondary meeting invitation. We send them some resources that we created, including the ways of supporting ourselves as an educator of color, or supporting our programs as endangering programs. And then we move on from self-reflective purpose to curriculum building purpose. But how to use them, that's something that we need to be more aware, because many teachers, they may not realize who they are before they're adopting a unit of identity. How can you teach your students to find their own identity without knowing who you are yourself? And I think one purpose of our organization is to help teachers, mostly like me and some of my colleagues, how to realizing how we are, who we are, and where we are standing in this special political time, before we get more courage and just be more brave in front of students. Sometimes when there are some incidents happening in your classroom, how do you deal with it? But you need to get stronger. You need to heal yourself first before you can help others. You can educate others. You can spread out more positive energy.
So the projects with your students kind of ties in with that about their identity. So yeah. You have taken this journey and learned, and now you're reaching out to other teachers and like-minded people and building this identity and trying to raise awareness about it. But you also, as a teacher, and we all do this, trying to be a role model and help our students to find their place in the world, to find their identity and everything. So can you talk a little bit about what your project is that is so very powerful that caught my eye?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the project that Linda is talking about right now is there are six pieces of photography projects pasted on my wall in my classroom. And they are all done by students who graduated in the past 4 or 5 years. At that time, I was thinking about having a photography project of my AAPI students holding a sign, and on a sign they will say, I am blank, my identity, my ethnicity, background, and blank. So they will fill out those blanks. They will fill out the first blank with their ethnicity, background, whatever they want to identify themselves with. And the second blank, they will complete the sentence with more about themselves, in addition to their identity. Because we have heard many students are reporting the microaggressions that they have experienced since little. Our Asian American teenagers, they have overcome so much. So I learned a lot from their photography projects, and here are six of them, and I can read them aloud. For people who can't see them now, there's one, she was writing, "I am Filipino, but I'm not exotic," with exotic being capitalized. And another one, "I am Asian and I don't have to conform to Western beauty standards." There's one saying, "I don't need to be immersed in my heritage to be proud of it." And this person is biracial. Another one, this is an ironic, but it's a humorous line. He said, "I am pretty okay with being Asian," with a smiley face emoji there. And the next, I have also another biracial student. "I am Pacific Islander and Black, but that doesn't make me less of either." And the last one, I have another person who's biracial. "Before you assume my ethnicity, remember there may be things hashtag beyond your imagination." She wrote Wasian, Whasian, because she's half white and half Asian. And I've heard many students are using that term to identify themselves. If one side of their parents are Asian, the other side is white. So I think that was my first project with my students that I was really thinking that digging into the identity part. This project is not done by me with my Chinese class students. Not all of them that are taking Chinese. Only one of them took Chinese with me for 2 years. So I was reached out. The background of this project is I was reached out by a Korean American student, and she was in the spring after she got admitted into her college, and she came to me. She said, "Miss Wang, I always want to do something, and I think you're the right person. You're the only supportive person that I know that also represent me as an Asian woman, and this is something that I want to ask for your help. I want to start an Asian affinity group. I want you to be our faculty advisor." And I was looking at her, I said, "I'm so proud of you, but I don't think I'm qualified to be your faculty advisor because you are starting an Asian American affinity group. I am not American. I'm an Asian international. I don't think I know the struggles that you guys have been gone through because I didn't grow up." So it makes sense that she found me to be their faculty advisor. So this is the first object. This is the first project that we did after I became their advisor. And the next year we did a whole school Asian Pacific Heritage Month programmings. We set up three big stations, one with Bollywood dance, taught by two Indian American girls who are really, really good at leading 100 people dancing in the Kirby gym. And another big group of different students who speak a different language at home other than English. I think most of them, they are also coming from immigrant families. So then they were teaching different languages. At that time, we had students who hosted Cantonese workshop, Hindi Urdu, Filipino Tagalog workshop, and other languages workshops. We also had a third station groups who were just giving a basic introduction of Asian American, very, very brief history of it. And then our entire upper school, over 400 students, plus many teachers, we attended all the three stations, and it was really educational, but it was the first time in our school history. Nobody had done that before. From those activities, I think a lot of my Asian American students built up a confidence before they attended those workshops. They were hiding their home identity at home. When they come to school, they put on a mask and then they become an American student. When they come back home in the end of the day, some of them, they will speak the home language with their parents or one side of their parents. Some of them will hear the home language from at least one side of their parents and then respond in English. And some of them, they will maintain English at home. So many of them, they do not get to celebrate their own identity and heritage until the Lunar New Year or until their own cultural festival, and that happens once a year. So I realized that because we also send out a survey asking students, if you identify yourself as AAPI, what are some struggles that you you have experienced anonymously? And we receive a lot of responses. We had more than 200 students responded the survey in the year, in the same year when I started the Asian Affinity Group. And about 10% of them, they identified themselves as partially or fully Asian American or Pacific Islanders. And they answered it several critical questions, including what is one stereotype that you would like to dispel? What is something that you want people to know about your culture besides the terminology of your ethnicity group? What is some frustration that you could share that you want to see our school change in the future? And I was reading those responses. And again, it was so emotional for me to realize that how much I didn't know about those kids, even though some of them, they have the similar appearance with me. For my East Asian American students, we all have black hair, brown eyes, and this face. I also introduced myself to my upper school people. I said, I am a Han Chinese. That's how I identify myself before I came to the United States, because Han is my ethnicity, Chinese is my citizenship. And in addition to Han Chinese, we have 55 other ethnicities. We have Korean Chinese, Mongolian Chinese, Muslim Chinese. There are so many. So I have to identify myself correctly, Han Chinese. But when I came to America, it's not an option. You can't be that specific. You have to click, there's only one box, and it's called Asian American or Pacific Islanders. So I had to abandon my authentic identity in order to fit into a bigger system, which in the system that your specific identity doesn't really matter. And I told my student that, and I heard more students when they introduce themselves, they say, I'm a Han Chinese. And I was like, I'm so proud of you. And that person said, I didn't even know what Han Chinese was, but now I know. And I had a conversation with my parents, and it turned out that I am also Han Chinese. So I think being this role model, and many students are seeing me as probably the only Asian female person in their whole life besides their moms or aunts. What I do, how I walk, how I talk, how I interact with others really, really matters to them, because they see another possibility after they grew up, after they graduate, they may become a person like me. And I think that also gives me the power, that also gives me the reason of waking up every morning in a refreshing mode, and knowing that I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to show up. I'm going to, whatever I do, I know students are watching me. Students want to follow. Some of them wants to follow me. And sometimes I don't even maybe consider that this part of myself matters, but somehow it magically became the inspiration of some of my students. And I think it doesn't matter if you are a teacher of color. It doesn't matter if you are a marginalized group member, any teacher, including white teachers, Hispanic teachers, Latino, Latina, Latinx teachers, Black teachers, LGBTQ plus teachers, all the teachers, multiracial teachers, teachers with conservative ideas, teachers with more progressive ideas, teachers who are religious, teachers who are non-religious, teachers who have neurodivergent needs, teachers who are single parent teachers who are immigrants. I think all teachers, you always have something that some of your students are looking up at you. Some of the teachers, some of your students are relying on you every day, even though you don't teach them, but you are there. Your image is there, your appearance there. Students, they see you and somehow they receive the energy from you in a distance or directly or indirectly.
Well, I hope everybody had a big notepad to take a lot of notes of what you said, because it is just so powerful. And there are a lot of schools that the awareness, a lot of teachers too, their awareness is raised, but they're not sure what to do. They're not sure what's the next step. They're not sure about the labeling, or, you know, how do you approach it with someone? And how do you support and respect it? And I think one of the first things to start with for a lot of teachers is that thing about pronouncing the name correctly and asking ahead of time. If you have a student in your class and their name is different or you're not sure how to pronounce it, then ask, be respectful and ask up front. I've seen so many teachers that call roll and they'll say the student's name incorrectly and the student will say, my name is, and the teacher will be like, whatever. And that is, and yet that same teacher would be furious if that student dismissed them with whatever, you know? So I think that's, everything that you've said is just so powerful. And I hope it really gives everyone pause to think and to become more aware and to make different choices and better choices in school, as teachers and for our students ultimately. So thank you so much. And thank you for all the great work that you're doing and the leadership that you're bringing forth for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then about the name thing, I think for me, I think the next one will be like really get to know your students, and not only about their names, not only about what they perform in your class, try to get to know them outside of our class. If you have this one little time that you can spend, try to attend part of their soccer game. Try to look at their art project. Try to see if the students has any friend groups that you also teach. Try to see there's any overlapped activities that you and the students are both engaging in. And I think by doing that, you will know a more comprehensive image. And the last advice I will give to teachers will be the same that I mentioned before: never underestimate your power to make a difference. And this is to all teachers. You are already making a difference during pandemic, and you are doing much more than you thought you were doing.
I can't add anything to that. That's the perfect ending to, you know, just a lot of perfect advice and insights. And I invite, like you said, you know, the teachers to know their world and be comfortable there, and then enter, you know, other people's world and try to understand it and become comfortable there as well. That's the whole interculturality that you also are very much an expert at. So thank you so much, Bonnie. And I'm going to put a lot of your resources in the description so people can reach out and they can learn more through your guidance and your wisdom and experience.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Hello again, everyone. This is your host, Linda Markley, and I'd like to invite you to nominate a teacher to be a guest on the podcast and to share their story. All you have to do is go to www.spiritofteaching.org and fill out the nomination form. Again, that's www.spiritofteaching.org. Also, please share, rate, and give some feedback to help us better serve you in the spirit of teaching. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to having you back next time on Teacher Tales.